Angus Young. How you doing?
Good, Becca.
The Offspring.
How's it going, Becca?
Dave Grohl. How you going, mate?
Good, man.
Pete, it's been a long time coming.
Oh, Becca, hasn't it indeed?
We go inside the dressing room, speak to the biggest names in music.
Keith Richards, the Rolling Stones.
And crack open their esky.
This is exactly how I imagined you, by the way, sitting opposite me with a vodka and orange.
You're a discerning chap.
This is The Rider.
Hey, it's Becca. Welcome back to The Rider. Last week, Ben and Chris from Silverchair. If you missed that, you can catch up right now on Apple or Spotify. And, well, what a weekend it's been. We knew about Kiss, obviously, playing in Sydney in front of a packed crowd in the stadium. But also over where Coachella is, they're doing Power Trip. Now, imagine this on Friday night, Guns N' Roses and... Maiden in the middle of Palm Springs in the desert, and literally just a few hours ago, AC/DC making their big return. Now, I'm just trying to do the math. It's been a number of years, put it that way, and of course, it was just a couple of years ago they came out with Power Up, but I've got to be honest, I'm still stunned that they're actually back. I mean, we kind of all thought that that was it for AC/DC. After Power Up, Brian Johnson had the hearing problems. We knew that was going to be an issue for them playing live. We had Cliff, who pretty much said, you know, he's retiring. And we had issues with Phil Rudd just traveling overseas. And of course, the tragic loss of Malcolm Young and even George Young as well. It's been a real tough time for the band. But it gives me hope that they're back on stage just a few hours ago. And there's going to be an announcement still to come. I reckon in the next few days, they're going to be coming up with something big. They don't do things by accident, say AC/DC. I reckon there's going to be either an album or maybe a world tour or maybe both. Tomorrow on recording of this episode, Metallica and Tool are going to bring it home for Power Trip. But yes, I think there will be some AC/DC news very soon.
This is The Rider.
So we've had some great episodes in this season of The Rider. The last episode before I take a break and wrap things up, but what a great way to bring it home. 25 years of the debut album from The Living End. Now, these guys came out of Melbourne. They were doing, you know, this rockabilly thing, and we thought, wow, when I heard this, there's something special about this band. There was Prison of Society in the debut single, combining these two songs. And when you look back on that debut album, there were some pretty damn strong singles. And that's just the first three. I mean, let's go through it. West End Riot. And then there was All Torn Down. And as a result, that debut album just kept going and going and going. It was in the ARIA chart for over 12 months. They won a couple of ARIAs as well off the back of that. And there's also a special gig coming up for the 25th anniversary in November at the Festival Hall. And of course, the 25th anniversary is actually coming up later on this week, but we've got Chris and Scott ready to go for a chat. And in fact, there's Chris already popping up on the screen in Melbourne. G'day, mate. How are you?
Hello.
How
have
are
you got
mate?
Me?
Yes. But where are you? So are you in your home?
I'm in St Kilda, but I'm just in a sort of a rental actually at the moment. We sold our house and we actually bought somewhere in Queensland. So this is like a bit of a stopover in between.
Yeah, a lot of the musos are moving up north. It seems to be the done thing, you know, cut your teeth in Melbourne and go for the sun.
Well, I think after LA, I just missed the sun too much. And being back here, I was like, you know what? I can kind of live anywhere. That's one of the luxuries, as long as I can get to an airport.
Yeah, exactly. It's not like sort of the early years where, you know, you got your patch of turf and your regular pubs and whatever. You know, when you're doing national tours, it doesn't matter where you start.
Exactly. I admit I'm not really out 5 nights a week seeing other bands and going to bars and stuff. I don't trust myself. I'm a bit of a homebody. Yeah, it's a bit of a lifestyle choice. So I'm down to my last couple of weeks here, really.
That's cool.
Are we waiting on Scott?
We are waiting on Scott, but you know, we'll keep going in the meantime. It's fine.
He's probably just forgotten.
Well, that's fine. Can you believe, though, that 25 years since the debut album? I mean, you know, I know you guys started a lot earlier than that. I think it was 91 or whatever, but that was when out of nowhere we all heard, you know, Second Solution, Prisoner of Society, and it just went from there.
Yeah, it was a long overnight success.
Yeah.
It was like Scott and I were playing in high school in 1990, Battle of the Bands and things like that. At the end of 1990, first pub gig was about 91, I think. There he is.
There he is.
You can hear me?
Yeah. It felt like a long time coming. It felt like we were, you know, we had sort of been two different bands almost before that first record came out. We were the Runaway Boys in school, which was us learning how to play and just learning 50s and 60s covers and obviously the Stray Cats repertoire that everyone sort of knows that we started out playing. Yeah. We did that for a while and then we sort of started writing our own songs, which were very in that psychobilly kind of vein. So by the time the first record came out, it was like a real melting pot of all the records we've been listening to and all the bands that we had sort of wanted to be and bands that we'd played with. There was the ska influence now and there was the punk rock influence and then there was the Aussie rock influence. Whereas initially when the record came out, it felt like we were already sort of seasoned veterans. We'd done so many shows and written so many songs, thinking we'd probably never really get much further than that, you know, to make a full-length record was probably a bit of a dream. And that's what that one was. We'd only done a couple of EPs before that.
And that now makes it all so clear about your style when you burst onto the scene as well. In fact, that first film clip of Prisoner of Society, I'd love to think that was every single gig you did in Melbourne, but you certainly painted the picture of a pretty wild scene back then. Was it actually a real gig?
It wasn't a real gig, but it was pretty indicative of what gigs were like back in those days. Because do you remember, there used to be so many all-ages shows. I mean, we're talking about 1998 here, and there was like in Melbourne, there was the Pushover. Like there was that crew called, you know, the Push, who used to put on a lot of all-ages shows at like roller skating rinks and all sorts of weird and wonderful venues. And these were the days. These were the days of moshing and crowd surfing. There was no signs in venues saying no crowd surfing. It was welcomed and celebrated. So I'd like to say that Prisoner of Society film clip,
the fruit bowl,
was pretty indicative. Fruit bowl was another one of those all ages things. Yeah, they were pretty wild gigs back in those days.
That album was many people's first taste of you guys and was in the ARIA chart for ages. Like how many weeks was it from memory? Like it was almost a whole year.
Something like that. I think it went like four or five times platinum or something and, stayed in the charts for a heck of a long time. I think it was it four, five singles or something off it. And the thing about the success of the band is that I think, you know, we were getting sort of so disheartened after a while that what we were doing was just not the kind of stuff that was going to get played on the radio. And it wasn't really the kind of band that got super popular. You know, we were that kind of different that, we knew that there was like a niche market and then we had our own little sort of subculture scene that we were getting quite popular in that. But the idea of getting like mainstream kind of success seemed pretty, you know, it seemed virtually impossible, which is why I think when it did become successful, it made such an impact because there was so many kids and things out in the suburbs that discovered this band, A Living End. They went, they don't look like any other band or sound like any other band that I've ever seen before. So when... You know, it's often the case if something's really outside of the square, outside of the box, once it becomes mainstream, it tends to really hit hard. And that's what happened with us. So, yeah, the record just kept selling and selling and selling. It was just, it blew our minds.
And then it went overseas. Like, I know that Green Day always reflected on, you know, touring with you for the first time. And you know, when they were asked about Australian music, you know, The Living End was the band that they quoted.
Yeah, well, we were lucky. We got a bit of a leg up from Green Day because it was well before we'd put out the first album that they came to Australia and we had written them letters to their fan club and blah, 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 with our demo tape and a T-shirt and a photo and saying, you know, we'd love to be your support act when you come to Australia. And lo and behold, they did choose us to support them when they did that first Dookie tour, which was, God, when was that, Chris? Like, that was well before the first album. The album was 98.
That was 96.
That must have been like, that was 96. Yeah, 96. That's what I was going to say. And so that was a bit of a leg up for us because a lot of people in Australia were going, hang on a minute, who's this band that I've never heard of that are supporting Green Day? You know, Green Day are huge. They were playing like big sort of festival hall size venues. And yeah, everyone was going, well, who the hell are this band that got the support that, that we've never heard of? So that was good. That kind of put us on the map a little bit. But then, yeah, like, fortunately, the relationship continued with Green Day. And when they put out their Warning record, we toured America with them. And that was a huge tour. That was like all capital cities in America, basically. It was a couple of months on the road together with them. And that was epic. And again, it kind of put us on the map a little bit over there as well. Made people kind of, you know, go out of their way and listen to us.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the thing. They obviously made a big impact on them. And look, listening back to that first album, all the songs were different. They could have almost been on different albums. I mean, I remember hearing how polished All Torn Down was, say, compared to Prisoner of Society.
Yeah, well, I think that's just an indication of how many, how sort of broad our influences were back in those days. We weren't kind of pigeonholed into one particular style. Like, yeah, sure, we came out of the rockabilly style, but we certainly expanded on it as quickly as we got into it. So, yeah, I guess, you know, the drive was there to not just create one kind of music but create other styles that we liked and also kind of try and mould them together as well.
Did you have a chance to go through some of those tapes from back in that era, the studio tapes, and find anything hidden? Like, are there any missing songs from those sessions that you might have rediscovered?
Nothing from those sessions. No. There's plenty of, like, demo tapes and stuff that we made in rehearsal rooms that had songs that never made it. No, I don't know about that album. I mean, maybe that was that album probably had all of the original songs in our repertoire pretty much.
Yeah.
But going on from there, when we'd record following albums, we'd do heaps of demos. So there was tons of songs that ended up on the cutting room floor that are, you know, that I hear from time to time. They pop up in whatever in my library or whatever. And yeah, they've all kind of got merit.
A lot of the songs, I've got a lot of tapes and things from recordings that we did in actual studios from back then, but it was, I don't know, I guess it wasn't before CD, but I don't seem to have many CDs from before that first album, but I actually have a few tapes. And Scott, you'd be surprised. I keep seeing like all these titles, like, fuck, I'd forgotten about that one. So there still was a fair amount of material that I reckon we sifted through before recording. We tend to have always had to write a lot of tunes to sort of decide on the actual ones. You know, just we've never gone, okay, let's just write the 10 for the record. Maybe no one does that.
And you've had a chance to repackage it for the 25th anniversary as well, which is, you know, pretty exciting. And Live at the Wireless as well included in that.
Yeah, I haven't actually heard that one. I find it very hard to listen back to those things, but I can guarantee you it's 100 miles an hour. It's probably 15 songs in 7 minutes, and it would be full of youthful enthusiasm, guaranteed.
One thing we always forget about, you know, living in songs is they're all pretty short and punchy.
Yeah. We were definitely on a mission in those days. Playing live was like, I think the way that we always thought that you had to blow the roof off the place was to really put the pedal to the metal and just play fast. You know, I mean, playing hard was one thing. You know, there wasn't too many ballads in the set back then, but everything seemed to be really fast. That seemed to be the way that we thought you made an impact. And I don't reckon it was till, you know, we probably got to maybe White Noise especially where we really learnt to slow down and groove as a band. But before that, it just seemed like we just had to play the bejesus out of everything.
I guess that's one of your ways of maturing is doing that. Are you more obsessed with a song and you keep tweaking it and tweaking it and tweaking it before it's ready?
Yeah.
I would say so.
It's always been the way, and it still is. But yeah, I think what we've learned is, you know, sort of going back to what Chris said, you know, everything was kind of 100 miles an hour and pedal to the metal and blah blah blah. I think what we've learned over the years, you know, because we have worked on a bit of new material this year, and what we've learned is that's what we do well. Like, we just don't want to go out on stage and play mellow, ballady kind of stuff. It just doesn't feel right for us. So I think what we've learned is to just, yeah, like, sure, we've recorded a few songs on previous albums that have been a bit more sort of light, you know, light on the touch and light on the energy. And it's okay to capture that in the studio, but when we go out on stage, we don't really want to play those songs. We just want to slam it out and put the pedal to the metal, as Chris said. What we've learned in that is to try and put the pedal to the metal, but with the groove, you know, with a bit more groove and a bit more kind of, I don't know, a bit more feel or something.
When's your first arias? Was that 99 when you picked up those two arias for this album? That must have been incredibly weird to be mixing with your peers.
Oh, absolutely. You know, like I remember going to the first arias and, you know, you see there's Darryl Braithwaite. There's Ivor Davies. There's John Farnham. You know, these people that you've only ever seen on television, you're standing right near them. That kind of freaked me out. I mean, that stuff wasn't lost on us. You know, I don't think we were ever kind of like, oh, whatever, you know, they're all the old guard. You know, we kind of looked up to all of these sorts of people, Jimmy and all the Chisel guys and the Oils and all that sort of stuff. So I remember that being a pretty big thrill. And then actually winning awards in front of them. And I remember things like, Angry Anderson presenting us with an award. I think it might have been at the Jack Awards or something. And he made this really great speech before it. You know, he said, now there's this young band, you know, they've released an album this week and they're bringing back rock and roll. And I just remember listening to him going, this is fucking unbelievable. I mean, he's like one of the kings of Australian rock and someone we sort of really look up to. And he's saying that he approves of what we're doing. So that was the coolest stuff about that was, A lot of those people in the industry were actually acknowledging the band for the first time, and they loved the fact that I guess they could see in us the kind of music that they probably started out playing initially, all that kind of 50s high energy rock and roll stuff. So it was a really exciting time.
It still kind of cracks me up, like sort of on that, but I guess our success in general, because we were such a subculture band to begin with, you know, we played rockabilly and we played psychobilly, and these are not mainstream styles of music in the 90s or the 2000s even. It was such a subculture, especially psychobilly. It's like a real niche kind of style of music. So back then, and even now, like when we played at the State of Origin at the Adelaide Oval, there's still like this little niggling little giggle that happens inside me where the words that go with it are, I can't believe they're letting us play psychobilly on the television. I just never thought that that would happen. And it still happens. It's fucking awesome. I love it.
Yeah, it must be plenty of pinch yourself moments where you go, I can't believe these people have idolized, you know, wanting to work with us and wanting to take us on tour. And then to think all those years later, you know, Chris and Jimmy just hanging out, having, you know, beers and you know, you joined the Barnstormers as well. I mean, it's all surreal. I love it.
It is. And well, it validates it. I think we always thought what we did was valid and that it should be accepted by more people, and that hopefully one day more people would like what we did because we liked it. When that first record came out and it hit as big as it did, it was, you know, it sort of, I think for Scott and I especially, it was like, yeah, see, we knew all along that we were doing something that was appealing. It was just that people hadn't been sort of exposed to it. And, but yeah, I mean, God, the opportunities that we've had just doing recordings with like Jimmy and some of the cool things we've done is, you do pinch yourself because we remember being in the, you know, in the van going up and down the coast, doing a lot of shows and always looking at other bands like Regurgitator and Spiderbait and Custard and, you know, the Fireballs even, you know, bands that we kind of looked up to that were on their way. They were making it, you know, they were on the radio. They were playing these cool university-style gigs when we were still playing at people's 21st birthdays and like tiny little bars in the corner to no one. We just thought we were never, ever going to crack it. So it was, I do pinch myself still. It's not sort of lost on me all these years later that not only did we achieve what those bands went on to do, we kind of surpassed it. It's bizarre.
Well, absolutely. I mean, one thing which I don't know whether it's been a strategy or whatever, but it does feel like you have paced yourself well all the way through the years. You don't endlessly tour. You have plenty of sort of breaks in the middle where you go off and do side projects, and I know you, you know, you were with me first in the Gimme Gimmies, and Scott, I know you had your solo project too, and you know, you've had all your other things going on. So is that a way of longevity, I guess, like, you know, so you don't get tired of each other?
Yeah, we're just smart enough to know that Australia's only got a certain size population. It's not like, you know, like the bands that we idolised in the late 90s and stuff in America. They can just tour all the time because there's so many cities to go and visit. The population's huge. It's just not, it's just a bit, you know, it's just a bit of a smaller pond over here, so it just doesn't make sense to keep going back and expecting the same people to keep coming back to see us. So I think we've just been wise about it, you know, and yeah, the upshot of it is it hasn't caused any burnout. I mean, there's been times when there's been a bit of burnout, but nothing nothing terminal, and it's been a really good way to roll because now we've still got all the energy in the fucking world to kind of keep going. Like, we're not, you know, doesn't seem to be showing any signs of slowing down.
I always sort of joke to people, God, you know, I've been in the same band since I was 14. I don't actually feel like we have done that much stuff outside. I mean, I guess there's been a few projects, but I mean, Angus Young's, that's a whole nother thing. I mean, he's literally been in one band since he was a kid, but
yeah.
I don't feel like we've done that much stuff. I feel like we've all sort of been, you know, in the living end, and I don't know. I kind of like that. That it's not like, oh yeah, they've done all these different things over the years. I feel like people look at the Chris Scott and Andy, and it's like, oh yeah, that's the living end. That's what they do. You know, they don't. Of course, there's a few things here and there, but maybe it seems different from the outside.
Oh, from the outside, it definitely does. But at the same time, whenever the living end came back after a bit of a break, it always meant something. Like, there was always something big just about to happen, and I keep thinking about you putting on a couple of gigs, like you got a one-off gig coming up in Melbourne, but I remember seeing you with the Lansdowne, like I think 2019 or 2018 maybe, and that was obviously launching into something, and it always kind of felt special when you came back from having a bit of a break.
Yeah, we always feel like we're coming back from having a break because we used to tour so hard, and we'd play, I don't know how many hundred shows per year, you know, it'd be up there, the numbers would be up there. So we were always playing. The wheels were always oiled, and we were always kind of in really good form. And often it feels like there's a long time between gigs sometimes. And it's like, oh man, I just sort of crave that touring mentality of just getting up and doing it every night and getting better and better and better every night. But yeah, like as we were saying before, you kind of just can't do that here, or else people kind of tend to take it for granted, I suppose.
I think we sort of said a bit like an event. We want it to be when we do play that, yeah, people get excited, and hopefully that's because we've tried to get better and you've got to be very careful you don't lose the intensity. Like if we're finished if we're bland or we're boring on stage. It's all over at that point for me. So I think we've always our shows have just kind of gotten better over the years. And it's like the Oils or Silverchair or something. Like, when they do something, people care because you know that it's going to hopefully be quality, it's not oversaturated.
Did you guys have to have a conversation, Chris, before you went and moved to LA? Like, did you have a chat?
We had to talk him down from growing his hair long, wearing leather pants. there was a few things. Yeah, there was a few criteria.
I don't remember there being. I probably felt a bit like, you know, hey, I'm thinking of moving over there. Is that going to be okay, guys? Like, you know, are we going to make this work? And a lot of people used to say, oh, so the whole band's over there, and I'd be like, no, I live there and they live here, and they go, well, how do you do shows? And it's like, well, you just fly in and you kind of do a day's rehearsal of blowing out the cobwebs and kind of off you go. Unlike the old days where we were living in each other's pockets all the time, it didn't affect the band, I don't think, in any way.
The good thing is, well, I mean, these days, particularly if you're doing interviews and media and all that sort of thing, you can do it all remotely as we are now. You know, it's quite effective. The LA life worked well on you, and I'm glad you're back, and you're now looking at moving north to Queensland as well. There's the scoop. But
yeah. I'm going to have a pair of leather shorts up for up there.
I mean, how did the rider differ, by the way, from the early years to how it is now? Is it a little bit more sophisticated with what you have backstage in the Esky?
Good question.
I don't think it's differed that much. The only difference that comes to mind is now we've got Barocca.
Yeah.
I don't think there's much else that's different.
No, it's definitely different to the early days where it'd be just like, like when we played the Richmond Club, they would just have like a bucket of beers behind the bar, of which I think we were allowed maybe 3 or something.
Yeah.
Remember gigs where we used to get a jug between us?
Yeah.
Did you ever try and push it when you started to get more successful? Like you must have thought, oh, you know what, we'll ask for a couple of bottles of Jack and yeah, a bottle of Moe. Why not?
Well, I remember when we sort of got management, when Ray Harvey started managing the band, because we had just done it ourselves up until that point. I remember the little things like, you know, she would start talking about like riders and, you know, we could get a crew guy, we could get a guitar tech and these sorts of things. It was like, no fucking way. How cool is that? You know, these seem like things that were way out of our league. You know, and she would make these little tour itineraries, you know, and book the flights and all that sort of stuff. That was just like, wow, we've hit the big time.
What was that like getting signed by a record company back then? Because back then it really was a big deal. Were you worried it could affect the sound of the band, or were you just completely embracing it?
I think, you know, I mean, early on when we got signed, like I always remember being at the Tote and playing one of those Rock Against Work things, and a guy called Carl Richter from MDS was the first guy from the industry really to approach us, and he sat me down and he said, look, I work for MDS. I've just seen you guys play. I think you're really great. Do you have any recordings or any songs? Are you thinking about putting, you know, releasing something? And I said, well, as a matter of fact, we are. We've just done a 9-track recording, which was Hellbound at that point. And I just remember at that stage thinking we were getting signed because of we had this unique kind of cool thing. There wasn't any kind of, oh, well, you know, people get signed and they sort of think, well, now you've signed me, you're going to try and change what we do and all that. We weren't thinking that because, especially in Australia, there was just so many cool, diverse, weird bands like Regurgitator and stuff that were getting signed to major labels. And it just felt like such a healthy scene back then that not for a second was I thinking, oh, we're going to have to compromise. I just thought, yeah, we're getting signed to MDS and they're going to put the record out and, you know, we're part of that indie alternative sort of scene. The idea of being stupid famous and successful wasn't really something that I thought would happen, but I just thought, oh, this will be cool. We'll, next time we play the Tote, we'll be able to have a CD to sell and they'll be, you know, we'll get some records in Greville Records or wherever else.
It really was a healthy scene though, wasn't it? Like everyone talks about, you know, the 90s into the 2000s as being just a golden era of alternative rock and roll. And looking back, I think we always look back on our teenage years and we're a bit biased. We always go, oh, things haven't got better since then and, you know, rock's dead, blah, blah, blah. But it was an incredibly healthy pub rock circuit back then.
It was, because there wasn't the diversity in options back then in life. Everyone listened. It seemed like if you were between the age of, like, 13 and like 25, you know, you tuned into Triple J and then you listened to the new band that Richard Kingsmill was talking about, and then they got added to High Rotation. Everyone started to know that song, and it wasn't like you'd switch off and, you know, look at your phone and be on TikTok or Facebook or Instagram or whatever. There's so many options these days that everything's so sort of fractured. Back then it seemed like everyone was digging the same stuff.
And the music festivals back then really spoke to that strength as well. Like, they were all really diverse. So think about a big day out. It was epic, and it was so incredibly diverse, you know, walking from one stage to another, some of the weird and wonderful things that you would see is great. So, yeah, it was – I know there's, you know, we're looking through the lens of nostalgia, but it really did seem like it was a really healthy scene.
Your first big day out must have been pretty insane. What was your memory of that? And particularly the flight to Perth everyone talks about.
It was a dream for us to be on it. And I just remember it was just an enormous crowd. Just like you standing kind of at the side or behind the curtain or something, looking out there going, holy Jesus, you know, this is something. And I just, it just sort of felt like we'd kind of arrived, you know. because we've done things like Pushover and Home Bake and stuff like that, I think, on the way up. By the time we got to those, that first big day out, it just exploded. People just, I think people just used us as an excuse to go absolutely mental out the front.
The big day out crowd was just hectic.
It was a pretty surreal sight seeing it from the stage, and, you know, doing it over and over and over, kind of knowing what to expect and going out there and going, yep, it still just amazes me that this kind of behavior is going on, because it was all just pure energy, and it was all, but it was all good energy. I mean, you know, they're certainly crowds like that have their moments and, you know, a bit of violence or whatever, but it was all pretty good energy. It was all pretty, everyone was there for the right reasons and having a good time. But yeah, my God, it's a surreal sight from the stage when you're delivering the songs and you play the first few notes of Prisoner and the whole friggin' field goes mental. It's pretty wild.
Oh, I mean, absolutely. And now, 25 years later or so, you've got your anniversary gig at the Festival Hall, which I'm so glad it's still open, and it's still one of my favourite venues in Melbourne. And so that's November 4. You're gonna do the album in full, or you're going to mix things up a bit? What's the plan for that one?
Well, I think we haven't really spoken about it. We just booked the gig. We don't know what we're doing. But I dare say we will be playing, yes, the record in full, and then, you know, and then playing a bunch of other tunes and making a night of it, because we've never done anything like this before. We did the retrospective tour where we played all the records, but that wasn't sort of a celebration of anything. It was just us flexing, I think.
Must have gone absolutely crazy at that point, because that was quite an undertaking.
It sure was. But this one, I think, yeah, we've decided we're either going to sort of ignore it, or we're going to make it or acknowledge it. And we have to acknowledge it. It's too big a deal to just, you know, to kind of just move past it. So hopefully a great night for all involved.
Well, it will be well received, and it's going to be a packed crowd, mate. I'd be loving to be up on a balcony spot there looking right down on the stage like last time. And 25 years of one of the great Aussie albums, and congratulations to you both. And it is so good to see you still kicking on and you know, new music. I can't wait to hear that when that does arrive, yep, in the near future. Chris and Scott, thanks for your time, and I can't wait to see you again.
Awesome, man. Thank you.
Thank you. Once again, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much.
And thanks so much for all the support over the years too, guys, too. I really appreciate that too.
It's exactly what was on my mind. I hope you could hear the sentiment.
I can. Good on you, boys. Well, I'll chat to you soon, okay?
All right.
No worries, mate.
Catch ya.
Good on you. Right. See you, fellas. Gotcha. Bye.
Bye.
What a great couple of blokes. There's Chris and Scott from The Living End. Wrapping up season 4 of The Rider. Got a whole bunch of thank yous. Thank you to all the publicists and all the mates I've pulled favours from, and Ben Gillies and Chris Johanyu from Silverchair, Billy Corgan. It's been a great season. Of course, I invite you to go back and catch up on all the ones you might have missed as well. Time for a break. I'll see you back soon. This is The Rider with Becco.